Hello, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit of yourself?
Yeah, so my name's Benjamin Blake Speed Watkins, and yes, that is my real name. I am based out of Virginia in the United States, and I have an undergraduate in mechanical engineering. And I currently work as a nuclear engineer, and then kind of do this philosophy gig on the side. And so I live in Virginia with my two kids and my wife, and I'm currently writing different things in the philosophy of religion.
Okay. What got you into philosophy of religion?
Well, so in my early 20s or so, I started to really kind of grapple with my faith and what it meant to me and kind of the justification for it. So that's when I really kind of began my journey into philosophy. And so these big questions were things that I just thought the answers were somewhere over the horizon for me. And as I began really digging at those questions, I really kind of saw my faith erode away. And kind of one day I kind of found myself in a situation where I was like, you know, hey, like I don't really think I believe these doctrines anymore. And so kind of I was standing on the ashes of my old worldview, and I was like, okay, well, where do I go from here? And so then I just kind of kept diving into philosophy further. And the more and more I dug, the more and more I realized that I just loved to pore over philosophical texts and to write different ideas and to dialogue with people who had similar big questions like me that they were working through, and trying to come up with answers as best we could, given the limited resources that we have as finite beings.
Is there anything in particular that makes you kind of question everything about your religion, such as maybe the historicity of it, or maybe the arguments? Is there anything?
Well, yeah, so there was two really big, I think, kind of strands that were being pulled on at the time. One had to do with religious disagreement. So this idea that there were all these different religious traditions and they were incompatible with one another. And so there was this problem of trying to adjudicate, okay, well, which of these is closer to the truth? And it was just kind of this lack of a method of resolving this sort of disagreement that really just kind of worried me. And then the other strand was kind of had to do with the natural sciences. So one of the things that I think, I don't think I realized it at the time, but naturally drew me to kind of the theistic worldview was this idea of a creator God, this God who was active in the world and who was participating in it, in its creation and evolution and how it's unfolding through time. And that idea seemed very much in tension with the idea of biological evolution. So the idea that we are the products of unguided processes, I didn't really know how to square that with this kind of providential view of God, where God is in control of everything. Well, why is he tinkering with creation in this way of biological evolution, of just kind of winding it up and letting it go? And so those two tensions, I think, were really pulling me in different directions at the time, and I wanted to resolve those tensions. But instead of resolving those tensions, I think those tensions got much, much deeper.
So, you're part of the Real Atheology, right? The name is
correct.
Yeah, Real Atheology. What's the goal of Real Atheology?
So our goal at Real Atheology is to explore questions in the philosophy of religion from non-theist perspectives. So we think that there is, in both the analytic and the continental traditions of philosophy, discussions going on about big questions in the philosophy of religion. And so we want to contribute to those questions. But in the philosophy of religion, it's very, very... points of view are heavily leaned towards theistic inclined thinkers. And so atheologians like ourselves are in something of a minority. Yeah. And so we want to help bring those resources to the table to help both theists and atheists who might be grappling with these questions have the resources that they need to kind of navigate their way through the landscape of philosophy of religion.
So one of the method that I always see within the discussion among theists and atheists in the philosophically is usually with debates. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, with the what?
With debates. So I see you make many debates. Either you are hosting it or you are being invited. One of the debates that I saw you do was with Trent Horn, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, Trent Horn, hosted by
Capturing
Christianity. So the method that I often see is debating. If you want to explore and then communicate, do you think debates is a good method in a way to communicate those ideas?
So I do think it's a good way to communicate ideas, but however, I also think that like any other method, it can have its drawbacks. So there's trade-offs kind of between discussions and debates. So discussions are going to, I think, be able to get at an issue more clearly, kind of a back and forth, a dialogue, but it's not going to be as amenable to watch and something that's going to be something that people are going to find entertaining. Whereas debates, where they may not be able to go in as the depth that you want to, they're going to be fun and they're going to be interesting and people are going to enjoy watching them. So they're a really great way to get certain ideas out there in kind of a as close to a dialogue as you could get in a way that's entertaining for people to watch. And, you know, I think there's something to be said for having to prepare for a debate. So debates are not easy. They require a great deal of prep beforehand. And I think that there's a lot of value in that prep process. So, for example, in my debate with Trent Horn, we wrote our opening statements beforehand and exchanged them before the debate. And so really that was to make sure that, you know, we're not trying to like score debate points with each other. Like it's not some sort of rivalry where we're trying to use arguments as weapons against the other and defeat the other. We wanted to really understand each other's perspectives so that in the following sections of the debate, we could interact in ways that weren't talking past each other or misrepresenting each other or somehow confused about the other's view. There was no curveballs being thrown. That way it was a back and forth that people could follow along and really helped us go as deep as we could into the philosophy of religion. And I thought Trent and I did a really great job of kind of bringing the Thomistic philosophy of religion and the naturalistic philosophy of religion to the table for people who may be unaware of how deep those conversations can go.
Do you think after the debate, you convinced some people or at least you communicate better, you inform some audience that's at first unaware of the atheistic sides of philosophy of religion? Do you think after the debates you communicate to them, you inform them? Do you think that?
Yeah, so I think in certain to a certain extent there, at least this is my hope, is that I was able to bring material to the table that people had not thought about deeply enough or that they found engaging and hopefully went and tried to read more on something or study more on some issue. I doubt I was able to convince anyone to change their position. If it was, they would probably be the exception rather than the rule, because I think a lot of the people that come to these debates are really kind of already entrenched in their camps and they're looking for resources either for the position they already hold or they're trying to understand the other camp better. Generally, I don't think there was a lot of people who were tuning into that debate who were entirely unfamiliar with the philosophy of religion and were seeing this for the first time. And if there were people who were doing that, it probably felt intimidating in certain respects because, you know, what Trent and I put on the table was, you know, pretty high level philosophy of religion stuff. I mean, he was appealing to argument, you know, cosmological arguments that have been put forward by like Rob Coombs and, you know, reasoning that have to do with infinities. And I was putting arguments from evil and modal collapse arguments on the table. So, you know, when people hear words like modal, who are not familiar with that, then, you know, that can probably seem pretty intimidating to some people.
Yeah. So when I see your debate with Trent, I position myself as, of course, obviously, I'm an agnostic, but I try to become convinced by him. Because I really want to have a chance to have my mind changed once again. You know, who knows, by listening this debate as an agnostic, as a ex-theist, I will somehow become convinced again. But I'm not convinced by the debate. Not because Trent's ability. He was awesome. I have to tell you, his debating style is very cool. I think he reminded me a little with William Lane Craig, maybe. But I'm not convinced. I think debates is not it's not the way for me to be convinced by my opponent or my point of view that is different than mine. So I think I personally think by making a content like this, podcast like this, is the better way to, if we really want to inform, communicate, or even to make people want to agreeing with our point of view. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, so I definitely sympathize with what you're saying as far as wanting to have a podcast sort of stage in which to present your material. Because I feel like certainly in the debate setting, there's pressure involved because you're talking back and forth, and you got to make sure that you're covering each point that has been discussed because you don't want to leave anything behind. Whereas in a setting like this, I can have all my notes in front of me. I can have prepped beforehand in a way that if I've left something out, I can say, okay, well, I've left this out. Let me go back and pick that up another way. And it's just easier to navigate and organize in a setting like this in a way that you can, you know, pace the discussion. It's kind of like the difference between giving a lecture in front of a classroom and going to, like, a team meeting. Like, in the team meeting, things are going to be, you know, divided amongst everyone in the room talking. Whereas if you're lecturing to a class, you're kind of in command and control of the room. And so that you can mm-hmm. set the pacing and the topics and the flow. And so if I had to pick one, if I could only do debates or podcasts, I would probably do podcasts, even though I would very, very much miss doing debates. But for those reasons, because I think that it's easier for you to be more thorough in presenting material in this kind of environment, I think, than in a debate. But it's certainly more entertaining and it can be more fun to do it in a debate. So again, it's kind of a trade-off thing. Really having both in your tool belt is the way to go.
So who's your greatest debate opponent?
I'd probably say Trent Horn. If not him, then I would have said Friar Pine. I debated Friar mm-hmm. Pine a couple months before I debated Trent Horn, and they were both not only very knowledgeable, but also very humble and very friendly. And so Trent and I will still communicate with each other about various things. We did another debate with each other after the debate we had with Capturing Christianity, where we did a devil's advocate debate about abortion. So I'm pro-choice and he's pro-life. Well, we switched it up, and in the debate, he defended pro-choice and I defended pro-life. And so it was a way of, you know, like, hey, can you really represent the side you disagree with fairly? And do you really understand the objections to your own position? And so, again, I think, you know, that was just another example of Trent and I kind of raising the level of discourse on another big, you know, religion is certainly a difficult topic, but abortion can be probably even more so difficult topic than religion because it's so politically charged. But we were able to come together and put together a really good product for people to listen to and really understand, because I think that's the depth that goes into the abortion debate is I'm pretty confident in my views in the philosophy of religion. I'm less confident in my views in moral philosophy. I think moral philosophy can be much trickier in certain ways than philosophy of religion. That's not to say philosophy of religion isn't tricky and that there are, you know, pitfalls and, you know, difficulties of its own. It's its own kind of beast, but I'm just more confident in the conclusions that I've been able to come to in the philosophy of religion than I am in moral philosophy.
Do you have any dream debate opponent?
Do I have any dream debate opponent? Well, yeah, I guess I do. So William Lane Craig is something of, I guess, a hero and a nemesis at the same time. So he's kind of the person who I see as someone as being at the peak of the debate circles as far as apologetics go. He's an incredible orator. And I also see him as the one who defends kind of the broadest brush of arguments. So he famously puts forward like five arguments. He goes through cosmological, teleological, moral, historicity of Jesus, and then kind of the reformed epistemology, properly basic type epistemology view. So he puts a lot on the table, so there's a lot to engage with. And so I would definitely like to one day have a friendly debate exchange with Dr. Craig, because I think that I can bring a good deal to the table as far as naturalism, and he can bring a lot to the table as far as his Christian theism. And I think the clash of those two would be really, really good. I think people would find that entertaining. And I like to think that I would be able to rise to that occasion. And because William Lane Craig, again, is very famous for having lost very few debates. Yeah. Some would say he's never lost a debate. I mean, so it's the top of the mountain as far as debating goes. And so that would, if I had to pick a dream debate, I think that would be it.
If there's a good argument that could persuade you into becoming a theist again, what is the argument that is in your mind? What kind of argument? Maybe cosmological arguments, or maybe teleological arguments, or another argument. Is there any argument that could persuade you?
Think it would be the ontological argument. No, I'm just kidding. not the ontological. I do. So the consideration that I think would really move me the most would be something from religious experience. So I think it would be less of an argument and more of an experience that would get me to change my mind. Now, that's kind of a cop-out answer here, because you can frame an argument from experience in ways that don't really resemble what most people have in mind when they think of an argument. When people think of an argument, they have premises and conclusion in mind and not an appeal to, you know, first-person subjective experiences that you know what, you know, other people may or may not have. So as far as arguments in the natural theology, as far as premises and conclusions and inferring the existence of a God from observations of the world or other surprising facts that may obtain, I find the strongest argument to be the arguments for design. So the idea that there's order in the world that somehow would give us a good inference to a non-physical mind that not only cared about this order in the world, but cared about us. The order was had some sort of purpose or aim that somehow had us in mind. So I think the best argument that theism has going for it right now is the fine-tuning argument. So this the idea that there are certain cosmological constants and variables that have that take values within a very, very narrow range. And so that we wouldn't say that all these values just happen to end up in these ranges by chance, but instead a better explanation would be to an unobservable mind that ordered the world with the intent of bringing about conscious life. And so I think that the reason that this argument has the best going for it is that it really, it plays by the rules of argument better than any of the other arguments. I think if someone kind of the other arguments don't quite get you what you're trying to get and kind of, you know, will have to appeal to very dubious sort of metaphysical speculations, but the fine-tuning argument I don't think does that. I mean, it starts with straightforward observations from science, and then it just puts two hypotheses on the table. It says, you know, look, you can have mindless chance processes, or you can have, you know, an intelligent design. And so it's, you know, which of these theories best accounts for the data. Now, I think that the naturalist comes out in the end ahead of the theist, because obviously I'm an atheist. But I think that as far as the distance that the argument goes in getting someone thinking of theism like a scientific hypothesis, I think that goes the most distance.
What's wrong with ontological arguments?
it's a great question. So with ontological arguments, so I think there are several objections to ontological arguments, but mine really begin with Kant. And so this idea that existence isn't a predicate.
Yeah.
So it's not something that we're not going to say that in, something is greater because it has the property of existence, or something is less than because it lacks the property of existence. Yeah. I don't think existence is something that is
great.
That is something that we can predicate of things like that. So the other thing is that I have the intuition that atheism is possible, and so that there's some possible world where God does not exist. Well, more contemporary versions of the ontological argument take as its first premise that it's possible that a necessary being exists, and so. This claim, if that premise is true, that premise entails that atheism is impossible. God couldn't exist in any possible world. And I just don't see any reason to concede that premise. If I'm going to concede that the view I currently hold is metaphysically impossible, there needs to be some sort of argument for that. And I've not seen that argument, or at least not that argument in a way that can't be parodied and mirrored to get the opposite conclusion. So famously, ontological arguments can be run in the other direction. And so I can say, you know, like if it's possible that a necessary being can exist, then he doesn't exist in any possible world. And so I can get the exact opposite conclusion of the ontological argument with my own supposition. So there needs to be some sort of symmetry breaker here. And again, I don't think I've encountered that symmetry breaker. I don't want to say that there is no such symmetry breaker. It's just I've not encountered it yet. And then the other objection that I have to it is really the form of the argument. It seems like it can be used to drive contradictions. So I might try to say that, you know, there is a necessarily existent, immovable object, God, and a necessarily unstoppable force, also God. And so it seems like if I've got a necessarily existing, immovable force and a necessarily existent, unstoppable force and immovable object, I've got a contradiction. I've used an argument form to come to the conclusion of a contradiction. And sound arguments can't give contradictory results like that. So there must be something wrong with this whole approach of trying to establish the existence of objects in the world a priori. So I just don't think there's this bridge from thoughts within our mind a priori, independent of experience, such that we can then go say, okay, the world contains or does not contain this object or entity. So I'm just skeptical of that whole approach.
Okay, so let's get back to teleological argument, fine-tuning arguments. How do you refute the fine-tuning?
So I think there are two really interesting objections to the fine-tuning argument, just in general. And so one has to do with arguments for design more generally. And so this is the idea of how do we know what God's goals are? So we're postulating a non-physical mind that has an intelligence and power to manipulate the values within the universe. And so how is it that we know that this entity, whatever it is, resembles human minds in a way that has desires and beliefs and intentions, and says, okay, I want to fine-tune each of these constants to have narrow ranges rather than wide ones. But why? So as part of a satisfactory explanation, there's a what and a why. So the what is obviously God. But now the question is why? Why did God want the cosmological constant to be this value rather than some other value? And why did he want the weak nuclear force to be this value rather than that value? We don't really know. And so I think this is a problem, because if we were going to say that the fine-tuning is the product of design, we want to say that it was a product of the design because it was the best means God had available to him to achieve some goal. Now, that goal might be obscure to us, but let's just assume that goal is conscious life. Would we expect a being with the power and knowledge to bring about conscious life to fine-tune the universe in such a way that the ranges of these values were narrow rather than wide? And I don't think we have any good reason to believe that. I think you're kind of building the fine-tuning observations into the theistic hypothesis. The theistic hypothesis is a spurious explanation in that. So really the objection is that the empirical content of theism is not at all clear. We have no idea what it would be that we would expect to see, given that there was a being with knowledge and power that we're supposing. So let me help illustrate this objection a little bit more. So Elliot Sober uses this example of you're a cook in a kitchen and you receive an order for oatmeal. And you look out in the eating area and you see your friends Bill and Jane. Now, you might wonder, who ordered the oatmeal? Was it Bill or was it Jane? Well, you have no idea who ordered it unless you're making assumptions about Bill and Jane's desires. Maybe Bill really likes oatmeal. Maybe Jane has a gluten allergy and can't order oatmeal. You know, these are the kinds of things that would help you discriminate between the hypothesis of whether Bill ordered it or whether Jane ordered the oatmeal. Well, we can't just make these up. We have to have some sort of independent motivation for thinking that these auxiliary assumptions that we're attributing to Bill or Jane are true. We can't just say, oh, well, Bill likes oatmeal, and Jane has a gluten allergy. Unless, you know, like, if we were to just assume that, that would be a spurious explanation. That would we would be taking something that we didn't have any independent justification for, and be building that into the empirical content of our hypotheses. And so, what we need to do is, you know, have some sort of independent motivation. Maybe you're friends with Jane's sister, and she's told you that Jane has a gluten allergy. Maybe you've been out to breakfast many times with Bill before, and he's always ordered oatmeal. These are ways in which you would have independent justification for those auxiliary assumptions that would confer a probability on the observations we see that can discriminate between the hypotheses. And we just don't have that. We're just speculating. We're just taking the surprising observation in this analogy oatmeal, and then just building it into the hypothesis of whether it was Bill or Jane. So I think that's the first really important objection to the fine-tuning argument. And the second one is more controversial, but I also think very interesting, and also comes from Elliot Sober. And that, so this is the idea that fine-tuning induces what's called an observation selection effect. And so according to the weak anthropic principle, we as observers have to take into account the fact that we are observers in the universe, and so that the universe is compatible with observers. Because if the universe wasn't compatible with observers, then we couldn't be here to observe it. But because we are here to observe it, it is part of our background knowledge that the universe is compatible with life. So it doesn't matter whether you assume theism is true or whether you assume naturalism is true. Whatever the case, you're always going to observe that the universe is compatible for life. So the fact that the conditions are right for life is not any evidence for theism over naturalism or naturalism over theism. So in order to avoid this observation selection effect, we have to change our observation. Observation can't be the universe is right for life, because we already knew that was going to be the case one way or another. And so the observation has to change to something like, to an observation that's not entailed by the weak anthropic principles, basically what has to happen. So you have to say the cosmological constant falls in some range, whatever it is, and that range is narrow rather than wide. And so then that brings us right back to that previous objection of, okay, well, why think that God would make this range narrow rather than wide? We have no idea. And so we come back full circle. And so mm-hmm. these two objections kind of work in tandem with each other. Because what's so intuitive about the fine-tuning argument is that the observation is surprising, that it seems surprising, that the universe is right for life. Well, once you realize that observation is not actually surprising, that's an actually expect, like, well, there's an observation selection effect going on there, all of a sudden that part of the what seems so plausible about the argument is off the table. And instead, you have this idea of, well, these ranges are narrow rather than wide. Why are those ranges narrow rather than wide? Well, once you find out that the theistic hypothesis doesn't actually explain that, all you've got on the table is an interesting cosmological observation and a what of the explanation, God, but you have no idea why God helps make that observation more intelligible. So I don't think it then competes with other naturalistic hypotheses. It's just another observation from cosmology we don't fully understand yet, and then that perhaps in time with more scientific investigation, you know, a unifying theory between quantum mechanics and relativity theory, perhaps whatever that theory looks like will make those fine-tuning observations intelligible. I don't know. So at the end of the day, I have to, you know, if you ask me, like, why do these values take these cosmological values take the values that they do, and why are their ranges narrow rather than wide? I don't know. I could speculate with, you know, multiverse hypotheses, but at the end of the day, I just don't know.
What do you think about the multiverse hypothesis?
So I think that it's an interesting postulation in cosmology. My understanding is that some of our best theories, so things like cosmic inflation, predict a multiverse. There's a lot of really nasty problems that arise in our understanding of quantum mechanics that a mini worlds interpretation will help kind of smooth over. So I think there are a lot of a priori theoretical reasons to postulate a multiverse, kind of like at one point we postulated black holes and we postulated electrons. So the fact that these are unobservable, I don't think counts against them. However, I also see these fields as being quote-unquote unstable in that, you know, what is a trend in scientific investigation in these decades, several decades from now, might just be completely off the table and be seen as, man, I can't believe we even entertained those ideas. It's just always in flux so much. So am I going to put all my chips in the multiverse basket? Absolutely not. Because, I don't think we have enough to say that it is anything more than a metaphysical speculation at this point that helps us smooth over inconvenient scientific problems that we've encountered in our inquiry in things like cosmology. I think it's interesting, though. I want to see something like that kind of take off over the rest of my life, so to speak. You know, see how the multiverse hypothesis progresses in the however long I have left to live. To see, you know, just see what comes of it. It's a very exciting area in science now that I don't really know how it's going to unfold in the end, but I'm rooting for it. And what would be really cool is if we could figure out some sort of empirical test that could either confirm or disconfirm it. That would be why I would be so excited for that. Even if it came out, even if it was falsified, even if, you know, like, hey, this observation disconfirmed the multiverse hypothesis. That would be incredible.
So up until this point, we still have no, we still cannot disconfirm the multiverse hypothesis.
We can't confirm or disconfirm it. There is no, at this moment right now, there's no, because the many different worlds in the multiverse will be causally unconnected, they don't make any empirical observations that we know of yet. We can't go out in the world and say, okay, ha, we observed this. And so that confirms the multiverse hypothesis. But we also can't go and disconfirm it either. But again, similar remarks seem to apply to theism too. one of the issues with theism is that the empirical content of theism is vague. And so it's very hard to go out and pin down this observation confirms theism or this observation disconfirms theism, because not everyone agrees on what that empirical content is supposed to be.
So let's imagine somehow in this life we finally find out that the multiverse is true. So let's say that this kind of multiverse has many infinite versions of us. So there is one universe where you make all the right decisions in your life. What kind of person you're going to see in that universe if you take all the right decisions in your life?
I want to make sure I understand the question. So you're asking me to suppose there's some possible world in the multiverse where...
Yeah, actually, this is more of a... this is a more of a personal question. I just... sometimes I like to ask questions that makes us rethink of ourselves and then evaluate our own ideas about ourselves. So if we can see a universe, so the multiverse is provable at this point. We can observe the multiverse. Okay, so in the multiverse, let's say this there's an infinite universe. There is an infinite version of us. So there's one. So one day you observe one of the universe, where this universe, there's a version of you, another Ben Watkins, that makes all the right decisions in his life. Well, what is he look like?
Man, I wish I knew the answer to that question. If I were to able to observe a Ben Watkins who was in a multiverse making all the right decisions, I'll start off by saying I don't know what that Ben Watkins would look like. I hope it would look very similar to the Ben Watkins in the actual world. But let's suppose that it looked very different from the Ben Watkins in the actual world. I would be most interested in the moral, ethical cognition of that Ben Watkins. I would want to know, like, what makes that Ben Watkins tick? How is it that he's able to discern all of the correct moral reasons given all of the non-ethical facts of whatever the situation is? Another question that I would have, maybe from this perspective, is, you know, how do we know that Ben Watkins is making all of the right, like, if we're able to observe Ben Watkins, like, how do we know, well, this Ben Watkins is making all the right choices, but this Ben Watkins in the near world is not? How would we be deciding that? Or would we be seeing a Ben Watkins life from start to finish as it is whole with all of the decisions, and then we could make a judgment that all of these decisions were right? I don't know. It's a very interesting thought experiment, but just off the top of my head, that's where I would be very interested in how it is we know that these people in close worlds were making all the right decisions. And then I'd want to know what makes their ethical cognition tick. How is it that they're able to do what they're doing?
Okay, let's get back to the argument things. What do you think about Kalam cosmological argument?
So the Kalam cosmological argument, I think, is an interesting cosmological argument. But I also think that it makes dubious moves at each step. So in one sense, the Kalam is misleading because there's two stages to the Kalam. Most people think that the Kalam is whatever begins to exist has a cause, the universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. Well, really all that is an argument to the explanandum, to the thing that we want to explain. Because the question that arises, okay, well, what caused the universe? It might be God. It might be a prior state of the universe. That argument doesn't help us decide. So there's then this inference to the best explanation, where it tries to say that the cause of the universe is, you know, powerful, intelligent, personal, spaceless, immaterial, things like that. And so I think at each of those steps, the causal principle that you appeal to, the observation that the universe began to exist, I think that's questionable. And then the inference to the best explanation of the cause of the universe being a God of classical theism, an omnipotent, omnibenevolent being who cares about us, I think that's a dubious inference as well. And so we'll just kind of go through those stages real quick. So the first is the causal principle. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. So I think that this is intuitive because it's a principle that would apply within the universe. But it's not clear to me that we can then move this causal principle beyond the universe itself. So causation might be something that only makes sense with a location in time. So whatever has mass also has weight. But it's not true that the universe has weight, even though the universe as a whole has mass, because weight is something relative to other massive objects. But we don't know if there's another massive object beyond the universe. We don't, like, we'd have a difficult time even conceiving of that. I think something's similar with a cause. This idea that there could be a cause of the universe before, there was a time before the universe, that before, I don't think makes sense outside of time. There's no way, if causation is going to make any sense, I think we're going to have a Humean view, or at least a Humean-like view, where causation involves temporal priority and spatial contiguity. And so while that causal principle might have all the plausibility in the world in the universe, I think it's quite dubious to take that principle and think that it will apply to the universe as a whole. The second premise is that the universe began to exist or had a beginning. And so I think that this is certainly a questionable premise within current cosmology, because it makes several assumptions, things like beginning to exist. So that language presupposes what's called an A theory of time. Well, there's an A theory and a B theory, and most people lean towards B theory. I don't know the answer between the A theory and the B theory of time. Putting that aside, I think if we were to describe that observation using the best cosmology available, the observation would be described more like our observable universe is extended finitely in the past direction. And so when you describe it like that, it's not so clear to me that you're going to get anything that remotely resembles a creation ex nihilo, something that's going to require us to invoke a non-physical mind in order to explain. And so I think that this, you know, the observation being cited in the second premise of the Kalam can be accommodated for with other cosmological models that are available. So loop quantum gravity is one. I think that it can explain the observations that we have. Is loop quantum gravity or anything of like that true? I don't know. Again, we're still in a very young place where our cosmological models are concerned, and we'll just have to see how those evolve over time. And so then the third piece, that inference to the best explanation, I think that's where this argument is actually the weakest. I think, like, really with the Kalam, you can concede the whole argument and say the universe had a cause, but there's no good reason to believe that this cause is anything worthy of our worship. So at the end of the day, the Kalam cosmological argument is not going to be able to undercut an argument from evil. You might be able to say that, like, look, the universe had a cause, but you have no reason to think that cause is benevolent or has any concerns with the well-being of humans, would answer our prayers, would defeat evil in the end, would offer us salvation, would rise Jesus from the dead. You don't get any of that from this argument. And so I think that when it comes to at the end of the day, if we're talking about cosmological facts and inferences to the best explanation, I don't think the theistic explanations really hold any water. They don't help us progress in cosmology. And if you read cosmological journals or go to cosmological conferences, you don't find hardly any talk about God's will in any of the scientific. Well, why? Well, there's kind of a presumption of methodological naturalism here. This idea that we will look for a theistic explanation as a last resort, but there's a presumption against them in science, and I think that's justified.
So, I think if we the cosmological argument, the fine-tuning argument, I believe most of these arguments works. But the problem is we just don't know which God that's involved in the process. This is my opinion, but I think the debate between theism has to go this way. So here it is. I think before the theists debate the atheist or the non-theist, the religions, all the religions in the world with their own God claim, has to do some kind of like Royal Rumble, where they have a competition debating each other to decide which God is the most true among them all. Because the problem with these arguments, we can presuppose every God, literally all God, we can say that, oh, maybe the God is Zeus, or maybe the God is Allah or Yahweh, or any of these gods are compatible. So I think the problem is, the solution is, they have to do the debate first, and then the winner debates with the non-theist. What do you think about that?
So I definitely see that as the broad, like, it's kind of all these different religious traditions are having to, like you said, have a like a battle royale where they're having they're trying to discriminate between each of these views to see who comes out on top at the end. And so there's obviously the practical issue of, like, that's just not practically feasible for all of the religious traditions to agree on who they want to go represent them in this battle royale, nor would they practically agree to the outcome of it. You know, if for whatever reason, you know, Mormons ended up on the top at the end of this, I don't see any reason why, like, the Roman Catholics would be like, well, okay, I guess Mormonism won out in the end. I don't think that would happen. But I do think there's something to be said for this method of trying out these different religious views and hypotheses and comparing the worldviews with one another. So this is something I've done myself, especially early in my philosophy career. As I was trying, you know, I was looking into Buddhism, I was looking into Taoism, I was looking into Stoicism, I was looking into Judaism. I was really, kind of a broad brush trying to understand all the different models of religious hypotheses or religious forms of life, and, you know, testing them out, trying them on in a certain sense. You know, kind of like going and shopping for clothes. You pick out a bunch of just different clothes, and then you go back to the changing room and try them all on and see which ones fit best. I think there's something to be said for that when it comes to deciding between your religious beliefs and your religious traditions. In a way, that's its own journey. And that I think that journey is valuable, even if in the end you're a lifelong seeker who never really truly finds a religious home, so to speak, you know, kind of a camp to set up, but someone who goes around and tries various different, I think there's kind of being a religious nomad in a sense. I think there's a lot of value in such an approach, and I certainly wouldn't want to discourage anyone if that's the journey that they choose to go down. I wouldn't want to discourage them from that. I would want to give them as many resources as I could.
Okay, that's a good answer. I think that's I think my idea is quite bad. A battle royale between religions. I don't see it going as well.
I'm here for it. My speculation would be that either Taoism or Buddhism would end up on top. Some sort of view that had a very simple, elegant form of life at its core, and that didn't focus so much on the metaphysics of it. I think a lot of philosophy of religions has gotten, not to say that metaphysics is unimportant, because I think it is important, but there's this emphasis on the metaphysics of it and not so much on the form of life part of it. And I think that form of life part of it is really, really important when it comes to a religious belief, because a religious belief is something that's going to be important for your everyday life. And so I think something like Taoism and the Tao Te Ching is absolutely sublime. I think it's in a way that the Bible just isn't. Like, if you were looking for a guy to help you live a good life, I take the Tao Te Ching every time over the Christian Bible.
Okay, what another argument that we have? What do you think about the moral argument?
So I think the moral argument is probably the most overrated argument for God. I don't think it's quite as bad as the ontological argument, though I do think it shares several similar deficiencies. So I myself am a moral realist. I think that there are basic moral truths, and that these basic moral truths are both necessary truths and objective truths. And so I think their necessity entails their objectivity. They just couldn't have been otherwise. It couldn't have been the case that cruelty was morally better than love, or that torturing children for fun could have been a right act. Like, I think that these are just to make such judgments is close to saying 2 and 2 is 5. Like, I just don't think they could have, like, in other words, I'm trying to say, I don't think these are surprising observations. Like, I think these are just givens. So I don't think they are in need of any further explanation. So this whole idea that basic moral truths need some further grounding outside of themselves in order to be true, and nothing could be morally good or bad unless a certain subject obtained in the world. I just think all of that is confused. Like the argument doesn't even get off the ground because it has the wrong meta ethics at its core. And so I also think that the argument falls the core of the moral argument is a meta-ethical theory about what basic moral truths are. And I think that view was just refuted 2,000 years ago in Plato's Euthyphro dilemma. And so I know that there's popular responses to this that say, it's a false dilemma. I don't buy those responses. So I think that either morality is reason implying or it's not. And so if it depends on God, then it's not reason implying and it's arbitrary. Mm. And so if it's arbitrary, then God could just, he could make something like torturing children for fun, right? He could just command us to do that. And then that just can't be the right. But if it is reason implying, well, then you're admitting that it's moral reasons which ground our moral judgments, and it's not God. And so morality is just independent of God at that point. And so people might want to say, it's a false dilemma. No, it's not a false dilemma. Either moral truths are reason implying or they're not. There's no third choice. The third choice here is to say, well, God is identical to a moral reason. And I think that's just unintelligible. That's like saying, well, rivers are identical to science. Like at that point, you're not explaining moral truths. You're saying the explanandum is identical to the explanands. God just is the basic moral truth. A fact about God just is the basic moral fact. And I can't make any intelligible sense out of that. I don't think it explains anything. And so the two premises of the moral argument are there are some objective moral truths. So again, if we take that claim, like I think we should, it rules out God as a foundation. So that premise doesn't get you there. The other is, if God did not exist, there would be no objective moral truths. Again, I think that premise is just straightforwardly false if we've accepted the previous premise that there are objective moral truths. So it gets us nowhere.
About God, what do you think about pantheism and panentheism?
So I'm much more sympathetic to pantheism and panentheism than I am to traditional religious. So what I find objectionable about traditional religious hypotheses are that they posit unobservable, non-physical minds that causally interact with the world. So that, but with pantheism or panentheism, that's not the case. There's only one substance in reality. So they're monistic rather than dualistic. So pantheism, to me, is entirely compatible with the naturalism that I hold. It just says that, look, this whole is of religious significance, and it is what we call God. So the universe is just another name that we give to God. And so I don't see any tension in that view with the naturalism that I'm inclined to embrace. Panentheism, I think, is even more interesting because it's the idea that we are somehow in God. So, like, we might be in God's mind. So, like, all of the possible ways the world could have been also entail the actual way the world is. And so in that sense, we're inside, like, of all the possible worlds, we're inside one of them. I think that's a really neat view that is also compatible with my naturalistic leanings. I like to fashion myself these days as something of a Hegelian. So I'm really into the philosophy of Hegel in both the phenomenology of spirit and his science of logic. And his way of cashing out objective idealism, I think, fits very, very nicely into a panentheistic model of the world. And so the idea is that the real is the rational and the rational is the real. That's Hegel's famous little tagline. And so what that's basically going to say is that, you know, we are rational creatures because the world itself is rational and we are features of that world. That's why we are rational, and that's why we can understand the world external to us, is because there's, you know, a congruence between our rational modes of inquiry and how the world will present itself for us to know it. And so in a very sense, we are within the world, and the world is this rational whole. And so, again, you can get a very nice panentheistic model, but you're not going to have, at the in either the pantheism or the panentheistic model, you're not going to have this mind over and above the world that is then looking back down on the world and caring about us and answering prayers and responding to our religious concerns. So what attracts me to the pantheistic and panentheistic models is their impersonal nature of it. So really, at the end of the day, what I'm finding objectionable is to find this person, a non-physical person over and above the world. That's, I'm an atheist in the sense that I don't think that's the case. My atheism is entirely compatible, though, with that pantheism of like Einstein or Spinoza, or a panentheism that would be close to Hegel.
So at least in pantheism and panentheism, we have no obligation to do worship, right? There is no religious obligation.
Right. We can still believe in and there might not be any afterlife. There might not be any answer to our prayers. There might not be any salvation offered to us at the end of our life. You know, these are just not things that would feature as models, you know, be features of a model for the sort of panentheism or pantheism that I would be sympathetic to.
I think if we promote the panentheism idea to the believers, to many religious people, without we introduced this kind of idea slowly to them, and then slowly this idea started to become popular among the religious. So here's the thing. I think panentheism is quite, if it becomes a religion, I think it is a very peaceful one, because there is no, you know, like religious interpretation about obligation, about morals and things like that. I just think maybe it would be a lot better if there is a new challenger in the battle royale who brings up the panentheistic God in their conception of God, and then they win all the battle, and then the final will be between the non-religious and the panentheistic version of God. So I think panentheistic is a cool, in my personal experience, because I still deal with many atheistic people. I live in Indonesia, obviously, so there are a lot of religious people. Even most of my friends still are religious. If I present them the idea of panentheistic, I can tell them everything about my own lack belief without sounding like I am an agnostic. I can still say things with a religious words about God, which I don't believe, and then they still kind of think that, oh yeah, so you still believe in God. Yeah, I just said, yeah, panentheistic God is quite, like you said, like quite cool. It's quite cool, and then I think it's harmless in a sense that it won't influence people to do bad things. Obviously, I'm not so serious about the battle royale thing, but you know, what do you think about it?
No, I totally agree with you, and I kind of want to throw in a plug here for one of my friends, so Joshua Rasmussen, and if I'm misrepresenting your views, Josh, just let me know if you've heard it when you hear this. but he has a monistic view of God that is close to panentheism. If it's not just outright is panentheism, and he sees God as the necessary foundation of the world, and so that this world, you know, the world is in a very real sense within God because God is its necessary foundation. Now, Joshua Rasmussen, I think he just got appointed at Baylor University as well. So I mean, Baylor. He is a Christian. Yeah, so he's. Still within that Christian tradition, but obviously taking this panentheistic model that he does raises some tensions within, you know, because classical Christian doctrine has a dualism at its heart, you know, that God created the world separate and distinct from himself and sustains it, and that we are created in the image of God, and our material bodies are of a wholly different substance than anything God consists of. So there's obviously things that have to be worked out there. But if anyone listening is interested in a panentheistic model of God that still works within kind of a Christian tradition, I would certainly recommend reading Joshua Rasmussen. Even if you're not interested in the panentheism per se, his writing is just fantastic. It's excellent. Highly, highly recommend it to anyone interested in philosophy of religion. I would say him and Alexander Proust are probably kind of the two big minds in the philosophy of religion. Like younger minds right now, you know, I don't want to say up and coming because they're both, they've already made it up there. They're not, I don't want to make it sound like they're not the elite professionals that they are, and they're certainly two figures that I will watch their career unfold for decades, as long as I can, you know, as long as I can, because they put a lot of interesting stuff on the table that's definitely worth engaging with.
Yeah, people like Josh Rasmussen, I actually contacted him. I asked him to come to my podcast. But he said he's still busy. He's available maybe next year. I contacted him via Facebook Messenger. In Indonesia, this is unheard of, or maybe some people would consider it is like taboo. We're not supposed to contact people, especially the academic one, except from email. And then I just, you know, I confidently messaged him and I asked him, and then he replied. I think it's unheard of in Indonesia, and I'm quite, my perception of the academics and my perception of him is changed. I think not only he's a brilliant mind, he's also quite very, very humble. He want to answer me, an obscure people from Indonesia, and then okay, of course he's rejecting or at least stalling my invitation, but he's answering my message. Is I think it's quite special, but I think it's quite special for me because he's a very nice guy, he's a very great guy, and I think he's already in his prime currently. And then is he a professor yet? I don't know.
So I know that he got an appointment at Baylor. I'm pretty sure it was a professorship, but I don't want to say the wrong thing while being recorded. I might have to go back and check. But I know that he was at Azusa university, but he is moving to Baylor. And so I know that that's a huge, you know, boost for his career. I know he's done work with Alex Pruss in the past. And so Alex is at Baylor as well. So the two of them working together as colleagues under the, you know, kind of the, under the same umbrella, I think a lot of really interesting and good stuff is going to come out of that. And I've been fortunate enough to have met Josh Rasmussen in person, and everything you said about like his humbleness, his willingness to kind of sit and talk with you, like all of that is 100% genuine. I mean, he is just one of the nicest, most gracious people that I've ever been able to sit down and have a discussion. And, you know, we sat and had a meal together, and we were talking about the philosophy of time, and just, it was one of the deepest conversations that you can imagine as far as philosophy goes. And he's just wonderful. He's just a great person to interact with.
Yeah. So this is my last question. I asked you that because if you have a chance to sit with four greatest philosopher in your own opinion, who would they be? Four people, if you have a chance to sit with them and have a meal and chat about philosophy of religion and everything.
Such a great question. Really great question. On that list is going to have to be Plato and David Hume, just because both of them are so close to my heart as far as really my interest in philosophy, but also writing. So I'm a really big into writing and literature, as you can see back here. And so they're kind of, you know, as far as philosophy and writing goes, those two are kind of, you know, I would absolutely love to have a conversation with either of them. My favorite philosopher, a more contemporary, who had passed away in 2017, was Derek Parfit. And so Derek Parfit was very, very influential for me, especially early in my philosophy career. And I never got an opportunity to interview him or interact with him. And I always, he passed suddenly in 2017. And so I always kind of really hated that I didn't get the opportunity to have an interview or discussion with him. So I think he would probably be in that list too. I want to make my fourth one. I want to say Hegel for my fourth one, but I also trying to keep in mind that I don't know what we would discuss with Hegel. Like I'm always like Hegel's kind of an enigma. He's like the puzzle that I've been trying to solve. So I don't know entirely what the discussion would be that we would have. So I'm hesitant to say Hegel. Another one, obviously, Albert Camus would be another philosopher who's also a writer. Who influenced me. So I think having a conversation with Albert Camus would also be, then again, you know, Plato spoke Greek and Camus spoke French. So, you know, I might not, Hegel would have spoke German. I might actually be able to speak with any of these. But that's Plato, Hume, Camus, and Derek Parfit. I think those are off the top of my head. Those would be four pretty high up there in the running. Kant would be up there in the running. Hegel would be in the running. Yeah. That was a good question. Man, I got to think about, I'm going to think about that one more after this.
Yeah, okay. But that's the last question. So, Ben Watkins, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was so much fun.